Hopefully, this morning, our relatives from Texas are with us again, and it's good to have Brother Jack and his wife. Is it Terry? I remember their first names, but I don't remember their last names. Well, it reminds me, when I was in college, I would call home and I would be talking about my fellow students that I had met, and I would mention their names, and mother and daddy would ask, well, what's their last name? I said, I don't know. We were just on a first name basis. So anyway, the first question that we want to address, and this has been in the queue for a while, what is the significance of Jesus' designation as the Son of Man? That description, Son of Man, is found 194 times in the New King James translation. It's used 16 times just to talk about a human being. Interestingly enough, Ezekiel is referred to as the Son of Man 93 times in his book of prophecy, and this expression is used of the Messiah 87 times in the Bible. I think the place to begin is to note that that expression, Son of Man, basically means you're human. Notice how it's used in three passages from the Old Testament. In Job chapter 25 and verse 6, Job says, how much less man who is a maggot and a son of man who is a worm. Now, if you know anything about Hebrew parallelism, you can see that manifest in this passage. This term man is parallel to that expression, son of man. It just is talking about someone who is human. The psalmist uses it this way in Psalm 8 and verse 4, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him. Again, you've got that Hebrew parallelism. And once again, in Psalm 80 and verse 17, let your hand be upon the man of your right hand, upon the Son of Man, whom you made strong for yourself. And so basically and fundamentally, that description, Son of Man, is emphasizing someone's humanity. But there is a special usage of this phrase in the book of Daniel that I really think is the basis, the primary basis, for Jesus' description of himself in the Gospels as the Son of Man. And the passage that I'm thinking about is Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 and 14. Where Daniel writes, and I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven, he came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. Then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. Well, who's the Son of Man in this passage? Well, it's the Messiah, or Jesus. Who is the Ancient of Days? Well, that's God the Father. And so the Messiah goes in the clouds to the Ancient of Days, and he is given dominion, glory, and a kingdom. This passage reminds me of a parable that Jesus tells in Luke chapter 19. Beginning in verse 11, the text reads, now as they heard these things, he spoke another parable because he was near Jerusalem and because they thought the kingdom of God would appear immediately. Therefore, he said, a certain nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and to return. So he called 10 of his servants, delivered to them 10 minas, and he said to them, do business till I come. But his citizens hated him and sent a delegation after him, saying, we will not have this man to reign over us. And so it was that when he returned, having received the kingdom, he then commanded these servants to whom he had given the money to be called to him, that he might know how much every man had gained by trading. Who's the nobleman in this parable? Well, it's Jesus. He goes away to the far country. What's the far country? It's heaven. And he is given a kingdom. This parable, I believe, reflects what Daniel was talking about in Daniel chapter 7. And so the primary significance when Jesus uses the term Son of Man is to stress the fact that he was the Messiah of Old Testament prophecy. Notice how Jesus alludes to this passage. In Matthew chapter 26 and verse 64, Jesus said to him, it is as you said. Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Now, Jesus doesn't quote Daniel 7 here, but I think it's pretty obvious he is alluding to Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 and 14. And then in Luke chapter 21, a passage that is not parallel to the Matthew passage, Jesus says, then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. Once again, he's not quoting Daniel 7, but I think he's obviously alluding to that passage. And you've got the same thing going on in some passages in the book of Revelation as well. When you look at the elements of Daniel chapter 7, Son of Man coming on clouds, Ancient of Days, all these other elements in that passage, the New Testament, I think, confirms in many verses, and you can relax because we're not going to look at these passages. I assure you, I looked at them when I put this chart together. But the New Testament, I think, clearly indicates that Daniel chapter 7 was prophesying the Messiah, and namely the fact that the Messiah would ascend to the right hand of God, and there he would be given dominion, a kingdom, and glory. When the Son of Man was given a kingdom, what was he given? Well, he was given sovereignty. He was given rulership. I just don't know why my clicker works sometimes and it doesn't work other times. Let's look at this passage a bit more closely. I'll not read it again, but notice what this passage tells us about the sovereignty of the Messiah, his dominion, or his kingship. We're told that he came to the Ancient of Days, and to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom. The Messiah's authority is delegated authority. He was given that authority by God the Father. It is universal authority over all peoples, nations, and languages. It is an everlasting dominion. He has eternal authority. And his kingdom will not be destroyed. He has invincible authority. So this passage tells us several things about the sovereignty of the Messiah. Basically, when we read in the New Testament that Jesus is the Son of Man, I think that is emphasizing two things. First of all, his humanity. But then secondly, it is emphasizing his messiahship. Jesus of Nazareth was the Messiah of Old Testament prophecy. Now, quickly, I want to talk about some things that are indicated by the context where this expression, Son of Man, is used in the New Testament. I'm not saying that the things that I'm about to point out to you are inherent in that description, Son of Man, but they are revealed by the context where this expression is used. Jesus said that the Son of Man has power to forgive sins. That tells us something about the Son of Man, does it not? He is the Savior. The Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. He's Lord. The angels will gather out of the Son of Man's kingdom. That tells us that he's king. And he will reward according to man's deeds. That tells us that he is judge. The Son of Man will save the lost. He is our Redeemer. He sits on the throne of his glory, again emphasizing that he's king. He gives his life as a ransom. Once again, he's the Savior. He sits at the right hand of power. He's the Messiah. Angels will be ascending and descending on the Son of Man, we're told in John chapter 1, verse 51. That tells us that the Son of Man is our access to God. Remember Jesus' words in John 14, 6, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. Again, he's the judge. He is the I Am. That's the way God revealed himself in the burning bush to Moses. And so the Messiah, the Son of Man, is divine. He is deity. He is the Son of God. So the context where this expression is used tell us several things about the Son of Man. But once again, primarily, it emphasizes Jesus' humanity and, more importantly, his messiahship. Well, the next question that we want to address, and this has been in the queue for a while, could you go over the words for love, their meanings, and maybe give sample passages where each is used? Now, before I do that, I want to ask you a question. I think the questioner is primarily thinking about the various Greek words that are translated love in the New Testament. So if someone had asked you this question, how would you go about discovering what these original Greek words are? How many of you, I'm not asking you to say anything, and I'm going to ask you to raise your hand, how many of you think you know how you would discover these words? Raise your hand. Mark raises his hand. Randy, Diana, Barry back in the back. Okay, I'm going to pick on Randy because I pick on Mark so much. I'm going to give him a break. Mark just happens to be the closest fella to me. Randy, how would you discover these words?
Somebody put me on to a Bible study program called Logos.
Can't imagine who that guy might be. How would you have done it before you discovered that Bible program?
Went to the Strong's
Concordance. Probably Strong's Concordance. Or you could have consulted Young's Analytical Concordance. Anybody, how many of you have a Young's? Randy has a Young's. How many of you have a Strong's? Okay. What's the one thing you know about Strong's? It is huge, right? Weighs a ton. Great big book. Well, that's the old way of discovering this kind of information, consulting concordances like Strong's and Young's. Now, I'm going to try to do something, and I don't know. It worked. Amazing. Using those concordances is the dinosaur way of doing it. What I did when I received this question is I went to my Bible program, and there's a tool in that program, and that's what Randy was alluding to, called the Bible Word Study Guide. And I've already opened that up, and I've already typed in the word love in that in the find box. And it pulls up this translation ring. And here's all of the words that are translated love or something similar in the New Testament. And if I want to find out what the passages are, I can click on a word and it takes me to this other word and it pops that out, and all these passages are down here below, and I absolutely love this Bible program. So, the first thing I had to do was discover, okay, what are these original words? And don't you like my picture? And when I did that, there's four sets of primary terms translated love. I say it that way because you got the noun and the verb form. There is the Greek word eros or erao, storge or storgeo, philia or phileo, agape and agapao. That's the term we're probably most familiar with. So those are the primary terms translated love. Eros refers to sexual love. Our English word erotic is derived from that term. Storge refers to family love. Now, I'm giving you a simple definition here. It's not quite as simple as this, but basically, this is kind of a rule of thumb definition. Philia, we might say, is friendly love, and agape is willed love, active goodwill. So, where are these terms used in the New Testament? Well, the term eros and the verb form, erao, is not found in the Bible at all. Bible writers don't use that term. And the term storge and storgeo, the verb form, it's not used in the New Testament either, but there are a couple of words that are made up of that word that are used. So, for example, in Romans chapter 1 and in verse 31, this word astorgos, And that A privative that's stuck on the beginning of that word negates it in the Greek language. So Romans 1, verse 31, undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving. That's our word, astorgos, not loving. And then in Romans chapter 12 and in verse 10, there is another word that is related to this word, philostorgos, Romans 12, verse 10, be kindly affectionate to one another. That whole phrase, be kindly affectionate, is this particular Greek word. Whoops, I didn't want to do that. And then there is the word philia, used by James in James chapter 4 and verse 4, where James says, if I can get there, adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? So that's our word, philia. The words philanthropia and philanthropos are translated brotherly love in other passages. And then, of course, the word agape is used many, many times in the New Testament. That's the word used in John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. But there are some other words that are used just a time or two in the New Testament that are made up of this word phileo. And you can see that at the beginning of those words. So you've got the love of children, the love of money, the love for man, love as brothers, the love of a husband. So you have these other words that are made up of this word. The word agape is not found, the noun form is not found in classical Greek. Now, the New Testament was written in Koine Greek or Common Greek. That period came after the classical period. It's found 20 times in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, but with no special meaning. The noun form is found 116 times in the New Testament, the verb form 142 times in the New Testament. And of course, it's used to talk about God's love for Christ and for us, and our love for God and Christ, and our love for one another. But notice how it's used in the Septuagint. In Genesis 34 and verse 3, it's used of Shechem's love for Dinah. You remember that story, don't you? He loved Dinah, but he wound up raping her. You see, that's not this high, exalted kind of love that we normally associate with the word agape. There are passages in the Old Testament where this word is used to talk about wicked people loving vanity or injustice or wickedness or words of destruction. Solomon uses this word when he talks about loving silver. So you see, there is not this high, exalted connotation to the word agape back in the Septuagint translation. But there is this high, exalted connotation with the way this word is used many, many times in the New Testament. W. Vine, in his Expository Dictionary of New Testament Words, says Christian love, whether exercised toward the brethren, toward men generally, is not an impulse from the feelings. It does not always run with the natural inclination, nor does it spend itself only upon those for whom some affinity is discovered. Love seeks the welfare of all and works no ill to any. Love seeks opportunity to do good to all men. In his little book, Flesh and Spirit, where he does a study of the various words that are used by Paul in his discussion of the works of the flesh and the fruit of the Spirit, Barclay says the meaning of agape is unconquerable benevolence, undefeatable goodwill. Agape is the spirit in the heart which will never seek anything but the highest good of its fellow men. It does not matter how its fellow men treat it. It does not matter what and who its fellow men are. It does not matter what their attitude is to it. It will never seek anything but their highest and their best good. Barclay goes on to say that it's the ability to love the unlovely and the unlovable, to seek the man's highest good. It's the ability and the power and the determination to love the people we do not like. Jim McGuigan, in his commentary on the book of Romans, says there's three kinds of love. There's if love, because love, and anyway love. If love isn't love at all, I'll love you if is self-contradictory, because love is healthy. I love you because you help me to be better is healthy. But it isn't the deepest level love. I'll love you anyway is the love of the Christ. There's nothing sentimental about it, for sentiment costs nothing and leads to no commitment. Love results in commitment. So this agape love is unlike the natural love that we feel for family and friends. It's not dependent upon our emotions, but rather upon our will. It suggests personal one-on-one involvement. It seeks for the highest good of the object of our love. It's God's kind of love. The kind of love that God has manifested for each one of us. And God shows us how to love. John says in 1 John 4, verse 19, we love because God first loved us. We learn this kind of love from our God. Now, there's a passage in John chapter 21 that is interesting, where Jesus asked Peter three times, do you love me? And Peter responds by saying that he does. But two different words are used for love in this passage. Jesus uses the word agapao, the verb form, in his first question. Peter responds, I phileo you. Again, Jesus uses the word agapao, and Peter responds in the same way with the word phileo. But interestingly enough, the third time Jesus asks the question, he switches. He uses the word phileo, and Peter uses that same word following that. Now, sometimes preachers will make a big deal about this. I think I have made a big deal of this until I read D.A. Carson's book, Exegetical Fallacies, and I'm deciding, well, maybe I shouldn't make such a big deal about the differences of these terms in this passage. Because Jesus uses different terms throughout this passage. He talks about feeding his lambs and tending his sheep and feeding his sheep. So is there some deep theological significance here to the fact that Jesus uses the verb agapao and Peter uses the verb phileo? Well, maybe, maybe not. Because both of these terms are used in the New Testament to describe the same kinds of things. Sometimes agape is used to talk about God's love for man, and philia is used to talk about God's love for man. Both of these words are used to talk about the Father's love for the Son, Jesus' love for Lazarus, the Father's love for the apostles, the disciples, or the disciple that Jesus loved. The Pharisees, we're told, loved the best seats in the synagogue, and they loved greetings in the marketplace. Both of these terms are used in different passages to talk about that. So, while it is true that the word agape and agapao, the verb form, often has this high, exalted sense of a deep, willed love, it doesn't always have that connotation. The Pharisees loved the best seats in the synagogue. Well, now, I would not have expected the word agape there, would you? But it's there. Men love darkness rather than light. Men love the praise of men. The world, now here's the word philia. The world loves its own. The wicked love a lie. Friendship with the world, where this word is used. So I guess what I'm saying is here is that we need to be careful that we don't overstate our case. Yes, it is true that the word agape often means this high, exalted form of love. That is certainly true when it talks about God's love for the world, the kind of love that we're to have for God. But there were a few times when this word is used when you wouldn't have expected that. Let me close by reminding you of what Paul says about love, and that's this word agape. It suffers long, it's kind, it does not envy, it does not parade itself, it's not puffed up, does not behave rudely, and all of these things. Do you manifest this kind of love in your life? Well, we certainly need to, don't we? How can I know if I do? Well, read this passage and substitute your name everywhere you see the word love. I think that'll tell you. Kevin is not puffed up. Kevin does not behave rudely. Kevin does not seek his own. Kevin is not provoked. Kevin thinks no evil. Kevin rejoices in iniquity, etc., etc. I think a good way for me to determine whether or not I manifest this kind of love in my life. Thank you. I hope this study's been helpful.